Hello, and welcome to the Commander Theory Podcast. I'm Nick Beatman, and I'm here with my friend, Zach Mack.
Hello, theorists.
So today, we are going to be beginning our series of set reviews for Lord of the Rings. And today, we're going to be going over our top 20 commanders for the main set. We're also going to have an episode where we go over the main deck cards that we think are interesting and a separate episode for the commander precons that are being released alongside the main set. But we're doing things slightly differently for this episode. There are over 80 new legendary creatures in the Lord of the Rings set. And in terms of the commander count, this is the second. This is the second most commandery set of all time. only Commander Legends Battle for Baldur's Gate had more commanders in it. So the density is extremely high. There's a lot to cover. But also, because this isn't a commander product, a lot of the legendary creatures in the set are clearly there just to support whatever limited theme. And I think the hit rate is just significantly lower than Commander Legends 1 or Commander Legends Battle for Baldur's Gate. So I don't think we gain a ton by being really exhaustive in our coverage of the legendary creatures. We kind of wanted to just focus on the ones that we think are most interesting, that add the most to the format, that build into new and unique decks. And if you think that we were, really negligent in leaving out, say, Bill the Pony or one of the other legendary creatures in the set, let us know. Let us know if you've got a really cool Bill the Pony build, because we're curious. We're willing to admit that we could be wrong in the selection of commanders we chose to focus on as the ones having the most promise.
Yeah, I also want to say that, I think there are some of the ones we're not going to focus on that are cool and fun, but you don't need us to talk about. I think that's another, condition for these commanders in particular. To use Bill the Pony as an example, because you're going to hear it right from the get-go. There is a deck that you could possibly make with this card if you really wanted to use as food and big toughness creatures. But exploring that in this sense when we have to make so many decisions about what to cover, or Rosie Cotton of South Lane is basically a token generator. A counter generator. Every time you make a token, you get a +1/+1 counter. Which is cool, but there's a lot of decks that do that. So if you want something that does that, that's not really breaking new ground, might not be the most interesting. So yeah, definitely let us know if there's one you wanted to hear. If there's an idea for one that you really like that we don't talk about, but yeah, we're not. It just was a little too much for every one card that was very fun and good. There was a get a food when a halfling attacks, and that's it,
yeah.
So don't be too mad, please, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, so we may address some of these commanders that we're leaving out when we get into the main deck cards, because Rosie Cotton, for example, is pretty strong in the main deck of some other commanders, in Gave or Marith, Will of the Wild. You can activate your commander's ability, remove a counter to make a token creature. Rosie Cotton triggers, puts a counter back on your commander. It's an efficient synergy there. But this episode, we're just focusing really on for the most part, we're focusing on commander applications rather than uses in the main decks of other commanders.
Yeah, exactly. And so if we do bring up a card in a situation like that, we'll read it off and talk about it. But this is going to be a long episode, just period. So just to make sure we could even have the time to record it as much as get some actual good content in with it, we hope that you'll forgive us for kind of skipping over some of the more generic ones. There's a lot of commanders in the set that are basically just funny ways to write power and toughness down. Mm-hmm. So that's a, you know, just some beef for a mana cost. So you know what to do with those. So we don't really need to tell you.
And of course, let us know. This is an experimental approach to a very strange set. If you would prefer that we cover every commander exhaustively and sort of just tell you, this one's not really.
Yeah, we'll just figure out how to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll try to make it happen. Mm-hmm. But before we jump in, I want to briefly talk about our Patreon. If you head on over to patreon.com/commandertheory, you can support the show and get sweet benefits, including ad-free episodes for as little as $1 a month. If you aren't ready to be a patron yet, you can help us out by rating or reviewing us wherever you get your podcasts. All right. I'm really quickly going to run through the commanders we are not covering. Again, if you think one of these is really compelling as the commander of a deck, let us know. But we're not covering Bill the Pony, Eowyn, Lady of Rohan, Faramir, Field Commander, Frodo, Determined Hero, Landreval, Horizon Witness, Rosie Cotton of Southlane, Samwise the Stouthearted, Saradoc, Master of Buckland, Bill Ferny, Bree Swindler, Elrond, Lord of Rivendell, Eorreth of the Healing House, Meneldor, Swift Savior, Saruman the White, the Watcher in the Water, Gollum, Patient Plotter, Gollum, Scheming Guide, Gorbag of Minas Morgul, Gothmog, Morgul Lieutenant, Grima Wormtongue, Lobelia, Sackville Baggins, Sauron the Necromancer, Witch King of Angmar, Witch King, Bringer of Ruin, Éomer, Marshal of Rohan, Éomer of the Rittermark, Gimli, Counter of Kills, Gloin, Dwarf Emissary, Grishnak, Brash Instigator, Celeborn the Wise, Eleanor Gardner, Galadriel Gift Giver, Glorfindel Dauntless Rescuer, Meriadoc Brandybuck, Legolas Master Archer, Peregrine Took, Quickbeam Upstart Ent, Faramir Prince of Ithilien, Gwaihir the Windlord, Pippin Guard of the Citadel, Prince Imrahil the Fair, Sharky Tyrant of the Shire, The Mouth of Sauron, Mauhur, Uruk-hai Captain, Sauron the Lidless Eye, Shagrat Loot Bearer, The Balrog Durin's Bane, The Balrog Flame of Udun, Ugluk of the White Hand, Gimli Mournful Avenger, Strider Ranger of the North, Aragorn and Arwen Wed, Aragorn Company Leader, Butterbur Bree Innkeeper, Frodo Baggins, Samwise Gamgee, Denethor, Ruling Steward, Old Man Willow, Elrond, Master of Healing, Legolas, Counter of Kills, Bilbo, Retired Burglar, Merry, Esquire of Rohan, Theoden, King of Rohan, and Saruman of Many Colors.
Woo! Right. Killed it.
So we've got 20 commanders that we are covering, and they're pretty much all bangers. So do you want to get started reading off this first commander that we're going to be going in depth on?
Yes. So this first one is, it's actually pretty funny that this character gets the first bit of limelight in this whole set review. So this is Boromir, Warden of the Tower, a 3/3 human soldier with vigilance for 3 mana, 2 and a white. Boromir says, whenever an opponent casts a spell, if no mana was spent to cast it, counter that spell. And sacrifice Boromir, Warden of the Tower. Creatures you control gain indestructible until end of turn. The ring tempts you. So do you want to talk about tempt right now so we don't have to at all?
Yes. So
it basically, it's the one of the big mechanics in the set, and how
basically there are cards in the set that say the ring tempts you, and what that means is when it happens, you get an emblem named the ring if you don't already have one. Then your emblem gains its next static ability, and you choose a creature you control to become or remain your ring bearer. So the ring has 4 abilities, and you gain one of them each time the ring tempts you until it caps out at the 4th one. So the first ability is your Ring Bearer is legendary and can't be blocked by creatures with greater power. The second is whenever your Ring Bearer attacks, draw a card, then discard a card. The third ability is whenever your Ring Bearer becomes blocked by a creature, that creature's controller sacrifices it at end of combat. And the fourth ability is whenever your Ring Bearer deals combat damage to a player, each opponent loses 3 life. And just for your awareness, a couple rules to note. The ring can tempt you even if you don't control a creature. Once the ring gains an ability, it has that ability for the rest of the game. Each time the ring tempts you, you must choose a creature if you control one. And each player can only have one emblem named the ring and only one Ring Bearer at a time. So, for the most part, it has to do with just making a guy better at attacking. So I would say, like, it's not a particularly strong mechanic. It's not the kind of thing I would go out of my way to include in my deck. But some of the rewards for being tempted by the ring are actually pretty good. And we're going to cover a couple decks where that's the case. That being said, do you have any thoughts you want to mention on the ring before we sort of go deeper on Boromir?
My only real thoughts about the ring are that it's like so much knowledge for like so little impact on the game as a whole. Like, I assume that Limited is going to be good because this is a set meant to be drafted. I'm assuming Limited will play pretty well. It's like some of these cards look really cool, but there's going to be a game that you're going to play in 8 months to a year from now where one of your opponents goes, okay, the ring tempts me. I pick this creature. And then everyone's going to have to be like, what does that mean? And they might not have the emblem token and like other things. They're like, okay, well, I killed the creature. So what now? Like, what's going on? And it's just going to be a mess. So I think for like what this is doing, it's not really a flavor home run. And it's not really like, doesn't seem like a super good fun mechanic, so you know it is what it is. This is what we got. So there you go. So
yeah, that being said, like the rest of this card is pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. And that's incredibly flavorful. I do have to say that like sacrifice Boromir, the ring tempts you is pretty on point for
yes.
The character. But yes, would you like to get into what the card is actually doing?
Sure. So it's worth noting that first triggered ability, whenever an opponent casts a spell, if no mana was spent to cast it, counter that spell, enables a soft lock with Omen Machine or Knowledge Pool. So Omen Machine, for those who aren't familiar with it, 6 mana artifact, players can't draw cards, and at the beginning of each player's draw step, that player exiles the top card of their library. If it's a land card, they put it onto the battlefield. Otherwise, the player casts it without paying its mana cost, if able. So when this comes down, if you already have Boromir, your opponents are basically limited to only the cards they've already drawn at that point. Because for the rest of the game, as long as Omen Machine and Boromir remain out there, their draws just don't happen. And the replacement effect or the like impulse draw effect that Omen Machine uses to replace it does not work with Boromir out. Similarly, Knowledge Pool kind of does the same thing. Knowledge Pool, also a 6 mana artifact. When it enters the battlefield, each player exiles the top 3 cards of their library. Whenever a player casts a spell from their hand, that player exiles it. If the player does, they may cast a spell from among other cards exiled with Knowledge Pool without paying its mana cost. So once you've got those two down, your opponents are going to try to cast spells from their hand, and Knowledge Pool stops it. And then the free spell that Knowledge Pool is supposed to give them to replace it doesn't work. So potentially not incredibly fun, but definitely a powerful thing you can do with Boromir. But potentially more exciting is making use of his sacrifice ability. So White, of course, has many good board wipes, using Boromir to give all your guys indestructible and then casting a Wrath of God. And then just like clearing out, just breaking the symmetry on your symmetrical board wipes is pretty good. It also works really well with small creature reanimation like Sun Titan, Celestine, Teshar, Bishop of Rebirth, so on and so forth. And you can just continually give your guys indestructible, you know, to protect yourself against your opponent's board wipes or just to synergize with your own. It seems very good. And I think this card is also a strong card in the main deck of a lot of decks. We haven't seen that many Selfless Spirit variants. It's pretty much just like Selfless Spirit, Dauntless Escort, and I think, and Boromir now, I think that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certainly a lot more room for these types of cards, and they're very useful.
Yeah, it's one day we'll get one of these that's like good in CEDH, and then it'll force all the costs of all these cards to go like, or I guess not CEDH, like I guess standard or something. I guess this isn't modern, but these cards will eventually go up because they're basically just gimmick cards right now. But yeah, if they keep printing guys like this, one day it's going to be more money. Not really a warning. we've gotten a Boromir, like, I don't know, when was Lavinia, was like 8 years ago or something, when return to Ravnica. No, it wasn't that long ago. It was four years ago. I can't remember. But yeah, they're not cranking these out. So if you think this is an interesting play pattern, if you like being in mono white, I would give this guy a shot. I think he's cool. And then, yeah, there's one more thing. Do you want to say the last cool thing about this guy?
Let's see. Well, I mentioned he's good in the main deck of a lot of white commanders. Definitely. Keep that in mind. It could be a potential format staple. Just as a point of comparison, Selfless Spirit is in 50,000 decks on EDH Rec. So, potentially a strong card.
Cool. Yeah.
But I'm happy to move on to the next commander.
Yeah, let's do it. So this one is Gandalf the White. So one of many Gandalfs in the set. Gandalf the White is a 4/5 Avatar Wizard for 5 mana, 3 white. He has Flash. He has you may cast legendary spells and artifact spells as though they had Flash. And if a legendary permanent or an artifact entering or leaving the battlefield causes a triggered ability of a permanent you control to trigger, that ability triggers an additional time. So another Panharmonicon in the command zone.
Yes, funny how close this was released following like the release of Elesh Norn, Mother of Machines.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing to note, leaving the battlefield, that leaving the battlefield trigger doubling also works with dies effects. So a creature with a dies trigger will also get an additional trigger from Gandalf the White. And then we have a list in the episode description. But this is a really interesting list. I love the granting of Flash in white. Not only is a nice little trick just for getting around opposing removal, allowing white to be a little more tricky, and to not like fully commit so much, and to just like not having to play at sorcery speed sure is nice. I love that you can just cast Gandalf at the end of an opponent's turn and then immediately untap and start doing things with him. This is the kind of design I would want to, or that's the kind of ability I would want to see on like a 5-mana commander where you need to untap with it to really start doing your thing. I built this deck with just a ton of like crappy eggs, just like cheap artifacts that enter the battlefield and draw a card. Paying 2 mana for 2 cards is a pretty good rate. I'm also running a bunch of cost reduction effects because once you've got like, you know, a Cloud Key or a Foundry Inspector or a Semblance Anvil, once you're like significantly reducing the cost of all of these things and you start paying like 1 mana to draw 2 cards, you really begin to go off. And it just like becomes very powerful. You see a ton of your deck, which is an unusual feeling for a white deck. And it seems really fun. We're still like a little light in terms of ETB effects in this color identity that like, well, ETB effects on artifacts or legendary permanents that are really impactful. So the deck looks a little bit different from like Elesh Norn Mother Machines in that way. You're not doubling up your Skyclave Apparition triggers or your Solitude triggers. It's most of what you're doing is just like drawing tons of cards, but that's fine. Eventually you're going to find your win conditions. And that's like, and also you're just going to be able to see your answers more frequently. It seems like a really fun deck.
I like this restriction a lot. I think the, like you said, the ability to play at flash is like, or at instant speed is going to make up for the fact that like, you're not really getting like super crazy value out of the second thing. Like the dies trigger definitely. But yeah, you basically hit the nail on the head. You're going to draw a lot of cards and you're going to play at instant speed. So even though you're not doing anything crazy, you might have friends that get upset at that. I definitely know that when I play decks that play mostly at instant speed, even if I'm not doing anything like insane, people feel like I'm hogging the game or something like that. So just, I don't know, be wary if you're playing in a card shop with randoms. But this is, I would say, a very strong but very fair deck, and it's only going to get better as more and more of these like cool artifacts and legendary spells come out. So yeah, I guess let's keep on moving. Do you want to get into this next guy? Or sure, I guess next lady.
Well, actually, we've got another Gandalf to cover first.
Oh, really?
Yes, we have Gandalf White Rider. This is 3 and a white for a 3/3 legendary creature avatar wizard with vigilance. Whenever you cast a spell, creatures you control get +1/+0 until end of turn, scry 1. And whenever Gandalf White Rider dies, you may put it into its owner's library, 5th from the top. So we've got a list in the episode description for this one as well. And this one is a more typical aggressive deck. Clearly, you're going to want to be casting a lot of spells in order to get as many triggers as possible. And also, you want to be making a lot of tokens or just getting a lot of guys onto the battlefield so that that like team +1/+0 has like a greater impact. I also really like the scry one tacked onto it. The way I'm building the deck is like all the efficient token generators I can possibly like stuff in here, and then a bunch of very cheap cantrips, because like, you know, cantrips, they replace themselves, they make it more easily that you can find more spells to trigger Gandalf again. But they also just work very well when you have Scry 1, because you're able to dig even deeper. Like turning all your cantrips into opts just makes it more likely that you're able to like get past lands clogging up the top of your library, find more spells. It's a really nice little addition to the card, and I'm excited to see more repeatable scrying in white. That's a really nice part of the card.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anyone remembers this at this point, but like when years ago when we talked about white and like the color pie and what was lacking, I was like, if we just give white like a ton of scry to put scry on like every other thing that white does, like that's most of what you're gonna need to fix the color. Like there's no reason scry should be out of the color pie, and the smoothing that it offers is like so nice, especially when you can do it multiple times. And it looks like they agreed with me, because we've been getting a lot more cards like this, and Gandalf the White Rider is pretty gnarly in that regard. Like you are going to be able to execute your game plan pretty flawlessly most of the time, as long as you can get him out. So it's pretty gnarly. I mean, like it's not very fast unless you have like the fast mana, you know, like making a board, casting Gandalf, casting some spells. There is like an ABC to that play pattern, but mostly because there's not that much haste in white. You can't just cast Gandalf, make an army, and then like a canned army and attack. But
yeah, you do have to like telegraph what you're doing, unlike with the other Gandalf, where you can just kind of you know, flash in, surprise your opponents. This one's like, oh, okay, you know. Mm-hmm.
But one of the
something is going to happen at some point.
Yeah, and I think like forcing the onus to be on your opponents to like, I'm just playing the game. I'm casting my spells. I'm making tokens. Do you have a wrath? No. Okay. Well, I'll attack you. And then next turn being like, okay, well, I'm doing this again. Do you have a wrath? Okay, you're dead. Like, the forcing the onus onto your opponents, I don't think is a bad thing. You just have to be okay with the times that they do have the answer. You know, and Gandalf himself has to survive too. You know, you can't get all these triggers without them being on the battlefield. So that's something else you might have to worry about. And Mono White's a little bit better at the mana these days, but still not the best. So watch out for that one. But yeah, I really, really like this guy. And you're right, I forgot about the second Gandalf. But yeah, now we're into some blue cards. Do you want me to read this one off?
Sure.
So this is Goldberry River Daughter. This is a 1/3 legendary creature nymph for 2 mana, 1 and a blue. And she has 2 abilities. The first one is tap, move a counter of each kind not on Goldberry River Daughter from another target permanent you control onto Goldberry. And blue tap, move 1 or more counters from Goldberry onto another target permanent you control. If you do, draw a card. So this one was, we actually got submitted by one of our patrons and a longtime Discord users. So do you kind of want to talk about, well, they submitted a deck list. We basically told everybody that we couldn't possibly cover everything in the set this time. But if there's something that they would like to talk about, a deck list that they like, to submit it. And this was one of them. So do you want to kind of get into this?
Sure. This comes courtesy of Dianea on our Discord server. And I'll just read off some of their comments. It's not inherently a powerful commander, but it does have a lot of mechanical synergies with like a lot of mechanics. It's fun to like fiddle around with charge counters, find specific interactions like sagas, cumulative upkeep. There's just being able to like, even though you can only sort of remove a counter once before you have to find a way to reset her, it's still really powerful when that thing you're doing is like, you know, removing a counter to get like the one of the triggers on Kiora Bests the Sea God again, or like Scroll of Isildur, and you get to steal another artifact or something. Chisei and Power Conduit and Tekuthal Inquiry Dominus all allow you to remove counters from things. So they all fit into the deck. They can remove counters from things sort of like before Goldberry is active, or they can just help reset your Goldberry so that you can use her to remove counters from things. She's also good for charging up things. If you can get charge counters onto her, you can move them onto like Magistrate Scepter, Lux Cannon, things like that. Although it does kind of require, I think like the best thing about her is like the proliferation synergy. Because basically, if you're just doing it Goldberry fairly, you're okay. I move a counter from this thing and then I move it back onto this other thing. It's just kind of like a slower power conduit. But what really like makes it appealing is, okay, I'm going to move this counter onto Goldberry, then I'll proliferate like the thing that had the counter originally and Goldberry, and just get more counters than if all of my counters had been stacked up onto the single thing I'm pulling from. So that's nice. Just the ability to like spread around counters and get more value out of your proliferation. You can also speed up her process of moving things with like Freed from the Reel or Pemmon's Aura or just other ways to untap her. Minamo, School at Water's Edge, Thousand Year Elixir, so that you can remove counters more efficiently, add counters more efficiently, draw more cards from her ability. So there's a lot going on here. we can we're going to post the deck list that DNA have provided, so you can take a look at some of these neat synergies. I'm always down for like comboing off with Magistrate Scepter. I think this is a really fun deck. I love that you're sort of getting value from the card draw as you're moving things around. Seems pretty neat. I don't know if there's anything you want to add.
Not too much, honestly. I do really like her as a commander. I think she's like, she reminds me of like Commander in like 2011. That's kind of the feeling I get here, but like updated. So she costs 2, so she comes down really fast. She does her thing pretty quickly, but she also like rewards you with cards if you can put stuff onto other things. There's a bunch of different build paths you can do with her, which is kind of one of the things about most of the commanders in this set is, and one of the reasons why we're not talking about a lot of them, is the same reason that Goldberry is good in this instance, where you could do like sagas, you could do charge counters, you could do +1/+1 counters, you could do flying counter. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that you could do. It's pretty left open to like the interpreter and the deck builder to create the experience that they want to create, which is really cool and feels like old school. But some of the commanders, they're like too open-ended. So Goldberry hit that sweet spot, you know, kind of like the Goldilocks of effects in the set, where it just like feels good to use, is pretty cool. Unless you play with a lot of fun cards and you can still like keep up at like a modern table, which is becoming more and more reason I don't like cards, actually, when I'm like, oh man, this just won't keep up at your local table. But yeah, I really do like this. The deck list is really cool. I love all the untap effects. I love this version of it has a lot of charge counters and +1/+1 counters in it. I guess charge counters on Everflowing Chalice and Eternity Vessel and stuff like that. So, I thought they had a funny name on them. But also things to take off. So you could take off like burden counters from the One Ring, which is a card if you don't know, we can talk about later, but it's going to be in the set. So you can pile counters onto her too, if you don't plan on putting them back, you know, to save yourself some hurt from things. I think that's pretty funny. So that's pretty much it, though. I'm good with Goldberry. Do you want to move on to this next guy?
Sure. Next we've got Erkenbrand, Lord of Westfold. This is 3 and a red for a 3/3 legendary creature human soldier. Whenever Erkenbrand, Lord of Westfold, or another human enters the battlefield under your control, creatures you control get +1/+0 until end of turn. This is an uncommon, so you may notice it's,
it's kind of understated, I would say.
Yeah, relative to, like, Gandalf White Rider, for sure. Although, because it's in a red color identity, there's things you can do that aren't open to Gandalf. You can get, like, extra combat effects to make it so that you're, you know, getting more value out of that +1/+0, you're getting more hits in. There's also like a few ways to make multiple humans off a single spell. So you can potentially like spend fewer cards than Gandalf to get a larger buff. But overall, it's kind of what you would expect. You're just running all of the good humans and a lot of aggro enablers. There's a couple fun things like Molten Echoes, Flame Shadow Conjuring, those just like Kiki Jiki, Jaxus the Troublemaker, a lot of like token generation that are like doubling up the number of humans entering the battlefield. There's things like Twin Flame, Kindred Charge that will just help you get more humans potentially for like only a single card or something. You want to be running all the human token generation in red that you can, even though there's not a lot. And just like generally good cards, some aggro enablers like Coat of Arms, Door of Destiny. I think this is probably a Bedlam deck just because you don't have a ton of options for evasion in mono red.
Yeah, just hit them harder. Just go go hard, hit hard fast. Red magic. Yeah.
And then there's a couple ways to like give your guys first strike that also work really well when you're only really pumping power. But I don't have too much more to add about Urkenbrand. We've got a list in the episode description, so go ahead and check that out if it sounds like a compelling deck. But if you have no more thoughts, I'm happy to move on to the next commander.
Yeah, not much. I really like this deck. This seems like a updated Meriton Stromgald, who is an old card. Some people really like him. Basically, like, buffs your team when they all attack, buff your team when they block, but is a 1/1 for 4. So, seems like you're going to get a lot of the similar gameplay as that list, but a little bit more sturdy, and your commander doesn't die to just getting a stiff breeze blown in his direction. So, yeah, this next one is our first green commander we're going to talk about. This is Fanghorn Tree Shepherd. And this is a wild one. This is a 4/10 tree folk for 7 mana. 4 blue. Does a few things. So the first one, tree folk you control have vigilance. Nice and simple, pretty fun, pretty good. And then whenever one or more tree folk you control attack, add twice that much green. So that's pretty good. Okay, so now my tree folk are also mana producers with vigilance. That's cool. And then you don't lose unspent green mana as steps and phases end. So the Omnath 1.0 line of text, keep your green mana around, but also just like, here's a huge way to generate it. So if you're playing a tree folk tribal list, you're giving them vigilance, they're making just a crap ton of mana, and it doesn't go away. So what can I do with all of this mana? And you know, Nick has an answer for everybody listening.
Well, it's fortunate that so many tree folk are really expensive. Because they end up being good good mana sinks for all the mana that's coming off of Fanghorn. Because you're in mono green, you're going to be running a lot of the like cast creature draw card enablers like Beast Whisperer, the Great Henge, Guardian Project. A lot of these tree folk are also large enough that you can rely on things like Elemental Bond, Garak, Primal Hunter, Garak's Uprising, Garak's Pack Leader, those cards, and Tribute to the World Tree. And then also a lot of these tree folks have high enough power that you can rely on the just like draw cards equal to something's power to like churn through your deck and refill your hand and give you more things to do with your mana. So it seems like a fun green deck. It's definitely slow to get going. You want to make sure that you're running enough ramp to like make it so that you're dropping a fair amount of tree folk and then getting to 7 for Fanghorn. Because yeah, it's a little tough when your reward for like the thing your deck is built around doesn't, you know, costs 7 mana. That is challenging. So just make sure that you can get to that point and have a decent board when he comes down.
And I don't think that you're going to have too much of a problem having a good board. I mean, this mono green, you're going to have your like mana dorks, you know, on top of your tree folk tribal, on top of your like any other things you could possibly want in your mono green list. Because your mono color and because your commander saves mana, things like Scepter of Eternal Glory are like very good here. That was the artifact from the Warhammer 40k decks. It's legendary. Costs 4. It says add 1 mana of any color, or tap to add 1 mana of any color, or tap to add 3 mana of any one color if you control 3 or more lands with the same name. So a delightful Thran Dynamo for colors of mana. If you happen to be there, you also get like stuff like the Great Henge. This is a good deck for like Invasion of Ikoria, kind of showing off a more recent battle that you might want to play in a list like this. So there's a bunch of stuff. I mean, mono green always will have an embarrassment of riches available to it. There's just a million win conditions. There's a ton of ways to draw cards nowadays. Like, just kind of do what you like to do with your tree folk, and you're going to have a good time. And that's kind of how I feel about this guy. Is there any other tech you want to mention?
One thing I do like in this deck is Assault Formation.
Okay.
This is the two-mana enchantment. Each creature you control assigns combat damage equal to its toughness rather than its power. And then green, target creature with defender can attack this turn as though it didn't have defender. And two in a green, creatures you control get plus zero, plus one until end of turn. So Fangorn has 10 toughness. A lot of your tree folk have more toughness than power. So this is naturally going to be a big boost. And it's also a great mana sink for all the mana that's coming off of Fangorn. So nice little piece of tech. But other than that, it's pretty typical, like kind of stompy green, draw lots of cards, play big boys kind of deck.
Yeah, and there's some cards in here in the set that I really like their addition and what they're doing to, like, with this deck. But we will talk about them when we get to main deck cards. So that's just a little teaser for all of you listening. You're going to have to listen to main deck cards to hear about some of the other cards that we like a lot. Speaking of cards that we like a lot, this guy is
he's
wild.
Strong.
Yeah, he's really strong. This is Radagast the Brown. So Radagast is a 2/5 Avatar Wizard for 4 mana, 2 green green, and has just a huge trigger. So whenever Radagast the Brown or another non-token creature enters the battlefield under your control, look at the top X cards of your library, where X is that creature's mana value. You may reveal a creature card that doesn't share a creature type with that with a creature you control from among those cards and put it into your hand. Put the rest on the bottom of your library in a random order. So Radagast is basically a like menagerie draw engine. So if you're going to have a bunch of different creature types, or even like a fairly varied creature base where you're not like you're kind of anti-tribal, you're picked cards specifically because they do not share creature types, examples being like Phyrexians or birds or what's like a funny creature, elk, you know, naga, squirrel, dinosaurs, pick your favorite dinosaur, you know. And I wouldn't even say that you necessarily need to have like zero others. Like, there's going to be more elves and stuff like that that you have. You just don't want to kind of cut yourself off at the knees.
Yeah, there. You can play the odds a little bit. Like, you know, in a 100 card deck, you can count on the fact that, well, I could probably run 3 or 4 elves, and the number of games where it like prevents me from drawing a card is probably not going to be highly significant. And of course, use the hypergeometric calculator to get like a more exact answer. But you can make some concessions, especially for like very, very powerful tribes. But I would probably avoid running like Llanowar Elves and Elvish Mystic and Finhorn Elves and Boreal Druid and yada, 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 yada. But, you're right that you don't have to go like fully singleton with your tribes.
Yeah. Cause if you like, it just kind of comes down to numbers. Like if you have 2 elementals in your deck, right? Like the chance that the other elemental is going to be in the top X cards is pretty low at that point, you know? So definitely pick wisely and make cuts appropriately, but you don't need to go like super ham. I know like there are people listening right now that are going to go super ham. Super encourage it. That'll be really fun, really funny. I'm into that totally, but just like if you're having trouble, if you like want to brew this guy and something is stopping you, then I would definitely just give yourself a little ease up on the reins a little bit, you know, and let yourself kind of write some stuff down and get some notes going. But yeah, I mean, what's some some tech? What's some cool stuff you like?
So I think this is a deck that like I've built a bunch of times before. I mean, slight variations. I'm running less elves than I normally would for this style of deck. But really, it's just you want efficient. Well, actually, it's kind of interesting. You don't have to go fully efficient, but you want a lot of ramp. You want powerful cards. The way Radagast's trigger is worded, you can afford to play creatures that are a little higher up on the CMC scale. So you don't want all one drops. But because it seems like a creature ball kind of deck is what I'm getting at. And you can, of course, run a lot of the same cards we were just talking about with Fangorn, like Guardian Project, Beast Whisperer, just to like help you kind of keep, just have multiple ways of potentially getting your snowball going. I also kind of like Cream of the Crop and Season of Growth in this deck. So Cream of the Crop is whenever a creature enters the battlefield under your control, you may look at the top X cards of your library, where X is that creature's power. If you do, put one of those cards on top of your library and the rest on the bottom of your library in any order. And then Season of Growth is 2-cost enchantment. Whenever a creature enters the battlefield under your control, scry 1. Sylvan Anthem is 2-cost enchantment. Green creatures you control get +1. Whenever a green creature enters the battlefield under your control, scry 1. So all these like scry effects, like library manipulation, make it so that you can stack your triggers and have, say, like Cream of the Crop resolve first. You dig through your top cards, put a creature that doesn't share a type with your board onto the top, and then have the Radagast trigger resolve, and then just like greatly increase your hit rate for not a lot of mana. I think just in playtesting, it's been pretty easy to like hit consistently and just like steadily replace my creatures, get more onto the board, keep like a relatively stable hand size. I just love that Radagast triggers himself when he enters the battlefield. Just quick hyper geometric calculation here. If you've got like 30-ish creatures in your deck, and they mostly don't share creature types, I think it's probably just worth it to run this guy. I mean, of course it depends on like the average like CMC of your creatures, but if you're like, you got a lot of 4-drops, say, and you've got like 30-ish creatures in your deck, you're at about like 75% chance to hit. I think it's like kind of just worth it to run this guy. And the nice thing is that like when he does hit, it's gas. It's not like, you know, Beast Whisper or Guardian Project where you can just hit a pocket of lands and, well, okay, I guess I'm not really doing anything else this turn. But with Radagast, when he's good, he's really good. So I like this commander. I think it's a fun twist on an existing archetype. And I'm kind of wondering if he's maybe not a new staple, but just like a card to keep an eye on. Maybe if he ends up being kind of cheap around the time of release, I think it might be smart to pick up some of these. I mean, again, look at your decks. You'll be able to tell how many of them he's going to be good in. But we also like, it's not clear exactly which of the Lord of the Rings cards are going to be given a Universes Within treatment, how soon these types of reprints are coming. And he does seem very good in the testing I've done.
Yeah, no, that is actually a really good point. Like, if you are looking to like speculate, I mean, there are people that are going to speculate on these cards. Because even apart from the serialized versions of cards, there's going to be the rings for the elves and the humans. Of course, the One Ring is going to be serialized like other stuff. So, and like extended art, you know, different foil treatments that, you know, the whole nine yards that they do every time a set comes out these days. There's still just the straight up question of like, they're going to reprint some of these. But which ones? And are they going to be okay reprinting them in like the Middle Earth flavor? Or are they going to want to transpose that into like a Universes Within thing? And which cards are they going to do that with? Is it just going to be the Gandalfs or something? You know, like like, what's going on there? Then there, we have no answers. So, just if you want to speculate on this, we're not like a money show. Just do your due diligence. But just do know that, like, there's a lot of questions around this set, and in the same way that the 40K set had a lot of questions around, like, print runs, what was going to happen. And just be smart, you know, don't make dumb decisions. Think about it before you go through it. Don't let FOMO ruin your life. Because these cards are going to be available for a while. This is obviously going to be a very well selling set. You're going to be able to pick up a lot of the non-chase cards for not too crazy much, I don't think. So, all of that said, I do like Radagast. Great draw engine in green. And we have some more stuff going on. So that was our last monocolored commander. We are now into the multicolored commanders. Do you want to talk about this first one?
Sure. This is Arwen, Mortal Queen. She is one green white for a legendary creature, Elf Noble. She's a 2/2. She enters the battlefield with an indestructible counter on her, and she has one remove an indestructible counter from Arwen. Another target creature gains indestructible until end of turn. Put a +1/+1 counter and a lifelink counter on that creature, and a +1/+1 counter and a lifelink counter on Arwen. So, Arwen is notable for being like the cheapest commander to have an indestructible counter, and also just one of the cheaper commanders to be indestructible. So there's a couple things you can do. The simplest thing is just to go like Voltron. By being indestructible, she gets she just like naturally has one of the characteristics that you really want from a Voltron commander. You can also like pseudo give her evasion by just running a bunch of board wipes and just counting on that to like clear the way for your beat down. I also really, really like the synergies she has with Berserk. So Berserk doesn't make you sacrifice the creature. It just says destroy that creature if it attacked this turn. So it's like a really free way to get in like maybe the last hit on somebody kind of out of nowhere. Other cool things about her, just the fact that she has an indestructible counter. I didn't like make this build, but it seems really fun and goofy to me. If you have, say, you're in like white green, you're in pretty good colors for creature tutoring, or sorry, for land tutoring. You can try to find a Nesting Grounds, which is a non-basic land, taps for a colorless, or you can pay one tap and move a counter from one permanent to another permanent. So you can move your indestructible counter onto something else. And that something else could be something like a Nivinyoral's Disc or a Boom Pile or a Magus of the Disc. You can just make yourself like an indestructible world destroyer using Arwen's counter, which seems kind of neat. Again, that's not the build I went with. The list in the episode description is just going to be like classical Voltron with like, you know, board wipes and stuff added to it. But that also does seem like a fun, goofy thing you can pull off with her. Even if you don't go with like the blow up the world route, you can also like proliferate the indestructible counter and then move it onto your other creatures with the Nesting Ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, always a fun. Also, yeah.
That could also be cool.
Yeah. There's just a lot of cool stuff with her. I think like the lifelink in particular is going to get pretty gnarly too. Like if you're able to dish out lifelink counters like crazy, that's really fun. Did you think when I saw the art, I thought she had flying for a second before I saw what character it was. Was that just me? Is that a me problem?
That might have been just a you
thing. Okay. I think it's just the way the tree is behind her. I was like, oh, wings. Oh, it's Arwen.
Let's move on. Our next commander is Frodo, Sauron's Bane. It's a single white mana for a 1/2 legendary creature halfling citizen. It has hybrid black-white, so two mana. If Frodo, Sauron's Bane is a citizen, it becomes a halfling scout with base power and toughness 2/3 and lifelink. And then it has black, 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 so 3 mana. If Frodo is a scout, it becomes a halfling rogue with whenever this creature deals combat damage to a player, that player loses the game if the ring has tempted you 4 or more times this game. Otherwise, the ring tempts you. So, what do you think about Frodo, Sauron's Bane?
So, from a design standpoint, I think it's pretty interesting. You know, a citizen turning into a scout, turning into this, like, ring tempt machine thing. It seems like this deck isn't doing anything crazy, though. Like, this just really seems like another evasive Voltron deck or something like a Virtus and Gorm type build where Virtus like is just a little guy trying to hit you a few times to kill you.
I kind of feel like you want to front load the temptation, like do as much tempting as possible, you know, play your 9 Nazgul or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and then drop Frodo and level him up just to like limit the exposure.
Yeah, so that he doesn't end up costing like a million. Because that's the thing about him is like, if you did your homework and tempted 4 times before Frodo comes down, then he's merely a 6 mana commander. Like, it is nice that you can pay that in installments, but like, when your commander just literally noob tubes somebody,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to be left on the battlefield very often, especially when it only like has 3 toughness. So you're going to definitely need to be able to protect Frodo. And luckily enough, you're in black and white, so you have a lot of indestructibility, you have a lot of reanimation, you have a lot of funny tricks to bring him back.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is not one that super... The flavor on this one seemed like the only justifiable reason to create a card like this, because it's like so much for a very, very small reward. I guess the small reward is you killed an opponent, but like, it just seems like there's so many hoops between that and you playing Frodo for 1 mana that it doesn't seem like a suitable reward. I guess you don't get anything for that. You're like, all right, and now if you don't kill him, I'm coming for you.
I mean, it is nice that you can take care of, like, you can front load some of the requirements, and it's nice that, like, you know, once you've fully leveled the ring, it's just that way for the rest of the game. But that's certainly not true of Frodo himself, and it does seem like a huge pain to, like, you know, level him up, like invest the 6 mana to get him to the top level. Someone kills him, recast him for even more, level him again. It's just like a huge mana sink in a color identity that is not very good at ramping.
Yeah. And I do want to say that, like, even though I might sound like I'm not super high on Frodo, and I'm not like crazy high, like if you wanted to play with like ring tempts you cards, this is like probably one of the better rewards for that. Like, we're going to talk about the best one, like
we're
later on.
About an insane one.
Yeah. At the end of the episode. Later on, we're going to talk about him. But this is like, if you want to play some fun fair magic with your friends and you want to play with a bunch of these like white and black, like ring tempts you cards, like this mechanic appeals to you or the gameplay appeals to you. And like I said, like I have not played with these cards. So maybe the ring tempting you is going to be super fun and I'm going to just want to have a deck that uses it, but maybe isn't as crazy as the next commander that we're going to talk about that uses it. Maybe I would want to play Frodo then. Maybe that's like the compelling argument with him. But I don't think he's bad, and I don't want people to think that I'm taking a dump on him. I just think that if, unless the above reasons, though, you like the tempt the ring or you like the character, are like enough for you, I think you can find gameplay like this in other places.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to our next commander. You want to read this guy off?
Yes, this is... I always wondered, because I couldn't remember if this guy had a name, and then apparently he couldn't remember his name either. So this is King of the Oathbreakers. This is a 3/3 spirit noble for 4 mana, 2 white black, is flying. And whenever King of the Oathbreakers or another spirit you control becomes the target of a spell, it phases out. So, you know, it just poof, not there for a little bit. Poof comes back at the beginning of the next turn. When the King of the Oathbreakers or another spirit you control phases in, create a tapped 1/1 white spirit creature token with flying. So just story beat, this is the ghost that Aragorn reminds that they're like, hey, no, I'm the king, you got to help me out. And then they come to help him because like years ago they betrayed the old king, blah, 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 blah.
These are the guys who kind of like took the wind out of that major battle scene. It's like, oh, that was easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You're like, oh man, the elephants are going to destroy. Just kidding. But this is cool. I really like this guy. So I would like to hear your take on him.
Sure. So normally I wouldn't be like crazy high on a commander where like the primary thing is like a defensive ability. Like essentially it makes himself and all your other spirits immune to like spot removal. But there actually are some fun ways to synergize with this. So there's a number of cards that either like are able to target a bunch of creatures for fairly cheaply, or target infinity creatures for very cheaply. So I think it's worth it to just like run a bunch of spirits, play King of the Oathbreakers, and then in response to an opponent's board wipe, or even just like at the end of an opponent's turn, phase out your guys for like 1 or 2 mana, make a bunch of like get them back on your untap step, get a bunch of spirits. Like it's just a good way to double your spirits in addition to being like really good protection against your opponent's interaction. So some very obscure tech in this deck. I'm just going to read out a couple of cards. So Arrow Volley Trap is kind of neat. It's normally 5 mana for an instant, deals 5 damage divided as you choose among any number of target attacking creatures. And if 4 or more creatures are attacking, you can pay 1 and a white rather than pay Arrow Volley Trap's mana cost. So the trick is you send in with, you know, 4 or more spirits, and after they deal their combat damage, during, like while they are still considered attacking during the end of combat step, that's when you cast your Arrow Volley's Trap. King of the Oathbreakers is going to trigger. All of your guys are going to phase out. Arrow Volley Trap, of course, gets countered for lack of targets. So it's just a way to cheaply get your guys phased out. Cauldron Haze, 1, and then hybrid white-black, so 2 mana for an instant. Choose any number of target creatures. Each of those creatures gains persist until end of turn. That's another way to cheaply get your guys out there. And then here's some weird ones. I got to look up the the Oracle text on these.
Yeah, I was excited.
So have you heard of Touch of Darkness? Of course not. This is a single black mana for an instant. 1 or more target creatures become black until end of turn. That's from Legends, kind of an obscure one. And then similarly, Heaven's Gate, also from Legends, single white mana for an instant. 1 or more target creatures become white until end of turn. So there's a handful of cards like that, just randomly target a bunch of things. There's also some good like damage prevention effects that like split it up so you can target a lot of things. Just check out the list in the episode description for ideas. But seems like a very fun deck. I like this. I like the play pattern. I'm so happy that it phases your guys out. Well, I like that it has a reward for your guys phasing in. And I also just love that it allows you to proc it by targeting it yourself. Because otherwise, mm-hmm. like board wipes would be tricky, would still be a problem for this deck if you couldn't defensively target your guys. And speaking of board wipes, because the whole like shtick of the deck is phasing out your guys, you can spend your like 1 or 2 mana, phase out all your men, and then cast a board wipe and just like break the symmetry on it. All your guys die. Mine are often Zalfir or whatever. So seems very fun. I like this deck. It's a neat take on black-white spirits.
No, I definitely agree with that. I think they're probably just hanging out in a cave, you know. They're like, just gonna hang out in this cave full of skulls. As ghosts are wont to do. But yeah, no, this is it's very cool. I really highly recommend you look at the deck list. It's gonna be in the description. There's been a lot of talk in the community about Wraths, and if you are someone who's been like, you know, maybe I should play more Wraths, but also end the game. Well, here you go. King of the Oathbreakers is flying on in to help you out with some actually really interesting gameplay. So this next guy is also white black. This is Lortho Corrupt Sheriff, which is very funny to me. So Lortho Corrupt Sheriff is a 2/1 halfling rogue for 2 mana, white black. So for a mere white and black mana, you get this ability. Whenever a player casts their second spell each turn, you lose 1 life and you create a treasure token. So that is Lortho Corrupt Sheriff. So I'm going to ask you this question before we get into like what you can do with this. Like, do you think this is going to trigger naturally on its own a lot? Like, do you feel like people are going to just be casting their second spells often?
I think so. And I don't think it has to. Well, first off, like, it doesn't say an opponent, so you can easily build your deck to double spell and get at least 1 treasure per round of turns.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, I feel like maybe your opponents are running a bunch of instants, but I think you're going to get some treasure off of your opponents during the course of a round of turns.
And I feel like the people running instants usually do the, like, okay, your end step before I untap, here's some stuff, which is going to give you some value there too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think this is probably fine. Like the fact that it doesn't specify who has to cast 2 spells, it's just whenever someone casts their second spell, is a lot more generous than they normally do with effects like this. So I was pretty into that. But with that said, like, what do you do with it? what are you going to put in this deck if you were to build it?
So you would want to run like some of the cards that synergize well with treasures, like Grim Hireling, just allowing you to sacrifice your treasures and kill things, get card advantage that way. Also, like, there are some good win conditions that work when you have a ton of treasures, like Revel in Riches just says you win the game on your upkeep if you have 10 treasures.
Yeah.
Marionette Master, like, once you get 10 treasures approximately, then you can threaten to kill anyone at any time. And that's pretty powerful. There's also just some random things like Mirkwood Bats or whatever. A common from this set that will also deal out a ton of damage as you're making and cracking treasure. So I think like the win conditions of the deck are going to be kind of unique. But I think that other than that, like, I mean, the hoop in this deck is just like cast more than 1 spell in each turn is if you can. And of course, like, you know, you can trigger it not only on your own turn, but if you got a lot of instants, you can trigger this on an opponent's turn. So it seems like it's pushing your deck to have low average mana value and to have a lot of instants. But really, that seems like the only major requirement. I think it's going to be kind of good stuffy overall.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a pretty good stuffy deck. This seems like a deck that is going to thrive in CEDH. And like, again, I'm not a CEDH player, but like, it's 2 mana. It generates like, who's the other guy that punishes when you cast non-creature spells from Kaladesh? What's his name? The Constable.
Campbell.
Combo. So this seems very similar to that, where like you're running good stuff, you're getting value. When your opponents do the things they want to do, you end up with treasure. So usually recipe for success there. I think this is cool. I know people are getting really tired of treasure, but I love treasure in these colors in particular. Gives them a lot more to do, and there's a lot of artifact synergies that work really well. You mentioned some of them, you know, like the Marionette Master, Grim Hireling, stuff like that. So I'm pretty down. I like Lortho, and this next one is also going to be doing some weird things with artifact tokens. So, do you want to read her off?
Sure. This is Shelob, Child of Ungoliant. This is 4 black green for an 8/8 legendary creature spider demon. She has Death Touch and Ward 2. Other spiders you control have Death Touch and Ward 2. And whenever another creature dealt damage this turn by a spider you controlled dies, create a token that's a copy of that creature, except it's a food artifact with 2-tap, sacrifice this artifact, you gain 3 life, and it loses all other card types. So, I'm going to get this out of the way right now. This is fake spider tribal, okay? It's not spider tribal. You really don't need a bunch of spiders in your deck. You can make do with like 3 or 4 spiders and you'll be fine. Because the thing is, like, your spiders don't, most of them don't naturally have a way to force your opponents to block them or just like deal direct damage. There's 1 or 2, like Spitting Spider and Silklash Spider, both can deal direct damage to flyers really efficiently, and those are amazing in this deck. But the majority of spiders, like, you know, oh, I'm gonna attack you with my spider, and now it has Death Touch, and your opponent's just gonna be like, well, okay, I don't block it. Or, you know, if you hold it back for blocks, your opponents are just like not going to attack into it and lose their creature. So you still require a third component to get the combo going. And if that's the case, maybe just like skip it. Maybe just not even bother. Because the thing is, Shelob herself is actually like a decent vehicle for killing lots of creatures with your spiders.
Mm-hmm.
If you give her like a lure effect, especially one, I mean, there's a handful of them that like also grant indestructible, which is crazy good in this instance. But if you give her a lure effect and just swing an 8/8 at your opponent with a bunch of untapped creatures and they all have to block and Shelob's got Death Touch, then maybe you lose your Shelob, but you just stole all of their creatures. And yeah, they're not creatures anymore, but I mean, who runs creatures for their stats these days?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if you can like steal all of their mana dorks and their, well, they'll probably tap it in response, but you know, if you can steal all their utility creatures just with your commander and one other card, that seems way more efficient than like trying to get my giant spider to wield this like Viridian Longbow or something to try to and keep Shelob on the board while I'm doing that. Like, that sucks. That's crappy. Let's just win with the 8/8. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is another reason I've been enjoying like commanders that just have like a chunk of beef on them, you know? They're like the meat and potatoes all in one, because it
you're
lets
circling back around to Timmy. It's been a long journey, yeah, a long arc for your character.
Exactly. But it's also like, I feel justified in doing it though, because like you're getting your value with your other things, but the game needs to end. So how does the game end? Well, I hit you 3 times with my commander, like, mm-hmm. like boom. And I got rid of all your creatures and turned them into food. So, I really like this Shelob, and I think that there are multiple Shelobs in the set. So, spoiler alert. But this one in particular lets you use like a bunch of funny cards that I've come to really enjoy playing my, Gale and Raised by Giants, the Muscle Wizard deck the last like year or so. So like there's a card that's, it's a pretty bad fog and a pretty good wrath, but it's called You Look Upon the Tarrasque. It's an instant, costs 5. Literally thought I would never cast this card ever when we were looking over the Baldur's Gate cards. But You Look Upon the Tarrasque costs 5/4 and a green. It's an instant. It says choose one, run and hide, which is prevent all combat damage that would be dealt to you and creatures you control this turn, or gather your courage, which is target creature gets +5/+5 and gains indestructible until end of turn. All creatures your opponents control able to block this creature do so. So that's so wild. With you're like, okay, well, I guess the best 13 creatures you have are food now. Like, wild. That's crazy. And on top of that, you do get like artifact synergies. Like, these food tokens are artifact tokens. So if you have things that can chew up artifacts and spit them out into other things, if you have things that grow with the number of artifacts, there's like a bunch of different things you can do with this commander that are really intriguing to me, on top of just being an 8/8 for 6, on top of just having the death touch synergies. So you're right, Nick. Like, this is not a spider commander. This is not an arachnid commander. But
this is an 8/8 commander.
This is an 8/8 commander. But it's a very, very cool commander. It's a very, very interesting one, and one that I'm hoping, I'm expecting a lot of people to pick up on.
Yes. And one last thing I'll mention, just to throw this out there, you know, because it's an 8/8, of course, like all the cards like Garak Primal Hunter, Soul's Majesty, Riskar's Expertise, whatever, just draw you an insane amount of cards for their cost. So please run those as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you can pick up a lot of, they've been reprinted into the ground. I think the most expensive one is Riskar's Expertise, which has still been reprinted a bunch, and it's like $5 or something like that. So you can get the cards, you can draw your cards in green, you can have a good time. And let's get on to our next our next guy. So this is another Golgari commander. This is another black green commander. And when they said they were going to have multiple versions of creatures in the set, I didn't realize how many versions of this character we were going to see. But what is it? It capped at 4. There's 4 of these guys.
That's weird. I only see one guy named Smeagol.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, that's so true. Anyway, this is Smeagol, Helpful Guide. So Smeagol, Helpful Guide is a 4/2 halfling horror for 3 mana, 1 black green. And has 2 abilities. The first is, at the beginning of your end step, if a creature died under your control this turn, the ring tempts you. So once again, we're getting some tempt going on. That makes sense. It's Smeagol. The second ability is, whenever the ring tempts you, target opponent reveals cards from the top of their library until they reveal a land card. Put that land onto the battlefield tapped under your control and the rest into their graveyard. So there is some debate in our Discord about about how much people are going to mill, because a lot of people just don't play a lot of lands. But in essence, that doesn't really matter, because you are going to get lands and you're going to tempt things, probably Smeagol, and I feel like you're going to have a good time. This is a pretty cool list, actually, is how I'm feeling about it.
Yeah, so I think it's relatively easy to get tempted by the ring in a black color identity. That's not so bad. I mean, once you have, I think I probably would run the Nazgul.
I would, yeah. At this point.
Yeah, like, because it's, I mean, a 2/3 death touch, you get like a ramp stapled onto it, and they get better in multiples, and then you can sacrifice them to Smeagol to get even more tempting by the ring. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's sack fodder and another ring.
Another ring tempt, yeah. So just to read off Nazgul really quick. So Nazgul is from the main set. We will bring it up in the main set too. But this is a 1/2 Wraith Knight for 3 mana, 2 and a black. It has death touch. It says, when Nazgul enters the battlefield, the ring tempts you. It says, when the ring tempts you, put a +1/+1 counter on each Wraith you control. And a deck can have up to 9 cards named Nazgul. So you can have 9 of them. You got 9 of them, and they're basically 3 mana tempt machines that buff each other. I'll have more words specifically about Nazgul at a later time, but I think I would run these here. You know, I think I would run, I think any of the decks that want to tempt as much as like this does, another secret guy we keep mentioning later, you know, I think I would just run all 9 of them, because you just want to make sure that you see this effect, and there's just not that many ways to do it, even though there are, I think, barely enough. I think we're at critical mass with the Nazgul to where like the deck can function, but like if you want to tempt like a decent amount, but not be very good, if that makes sense. Like it's your jalopy will be floppy, but it will be rolling, you know?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you something about just sort of the nature of this type of effect. We talked about this a little bit when we were discussing Realm Breaker in March of the Machine, but I mean, ramping using your opponent's lands is just clearly worse than ramping using own.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that opponent dies, then they all just go poof. What do you think is going to be your typical strategy for the ramping with Smeagol? Do you feel like confident enough in your ability to identify somebody who's going to like be in the finals with you that you're just going to pull their lands every game? Or are you going to try to like spread it around to like minimize the downside, like as people get eliminated, or just like what is your strategy going to be with these type of triggers?
That's a really good question. I think in general, just with, I mean, and this is specifically to our playgroup, like the first few turns of the game, you're going to be able to get in, like he's a three drop, and you're probably going to have some kind of evasion or something, an ebony fly or, you know, something going on. It won't be hard to hit somebody. And then I think it'll become a bargaining chip as the game goes on. Like, oh, why would I kill you? I have so many of your lands, you know, like, don't worry about it. Like, make a deal with me. That kind of thing. So I think like you just kind of have to be crafty about the lines that you're going to be taking with Smeagol. And I think that's actually one of the things I like about the card the most, is that not only he makes you think more than it looks like on the surface. Like, is this person in an alliance with me? Do they just want to keep my lands out? What's going on? Like, that seems really fun. And I think I would try to take out the person who is just going to ruin my day the most. And then whether that's the person I have the most lands from or not doesn't really matter. I think like the lands is like the bonus flavor. Like I shouldn't, if I get enough lands from somebody to do what I need to do, then I should probably start attacking somebody else, unless that person like needs to die, is kind of how I'm thinking about it.
Like, okay.
So I guess in that way, spread it out, because I don't think I'm going to kill that many people with Smeagol. You know, like with combat damage in particular.
Yeah, I mean, like the whole skulk thing on the ring doesn't work so great when your commander has four power.
Yeah.
I think that like I feel you're being a little too glib about like losing your lands, because that's like the main reward on this thing. Like, who cares about? I still don't care that much about getting tempted by the ring. But I do care about ramping a whole bunch at like a relatively low cost. What I think, I'm gonna cheat my own question and just say, like, what I'm gonna try to do with this deck is run cards that'll let me convert those lands into resources that are more stable. So yeah, like if I'm running like Harrow or Roiling Regrowth or the new Entish Restoration or Scapeshift or Elvish Reclaimer, Crop Rotation, Dust Bowl, even just all these ways to like sacrifice lands and in most cases like get new lands, I would, like, most of those cards I just listed are fine on their own, and they enable me to like not have to worry as much about whose lands I'm taking and how close they are to death. And then I might even run freaking Infernal Tribute.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Just the Infernal Tribute is an old reserve list card from like Weatherlight. It's like black, black, black for an enchantment. Pay two, sacrifice a non-token permanent, draw a card. So that is another way to like, if you're really afraid that somebody's about to die, you can at least get cards out of those lands rather than just get nothing.
No, I think that's a cool way to go about it. And like, I've been playing a lot more lands in general. Like, I put Dust Bowl in a bunch of decks like this too, where like I'm had a Herald of Fleshrak or something in the deck, and I was like, I don't want to give these back. So I could see that being a fun, fun for me line of play. And I guess it's like my opponent wasn't going to draw that anyway. You know, they shouldn't get too mad. You know, yeah. You know, it's all good. We're all just heading to the Mount Doom together. It's all chill. I like that. So again, like, I think this is a actually cool list. I think this is a cool interpretation of this creature. I think the meta analysis of this, like what happens when you start sealing people's lands, is pretty interesting too. So all in all, this is like one of the home runs for me as far as like creatures go. I'm like, oh, cool. Like, good job, guys.
Please check out the list in the episode description. It's got a lot more, it's got a lot of ideas for how to build around this commander. We didn't really go too deep into it because we talk about this kind of deck all the time, but
yeah,
lots of sac fodder, lots of sac outlets. Infernal Tribute has really grown on me because it's like, it's a sac outlet for the creatures when you want to do that, and a sac outlet for the lands when you want to do that. Anyway, God, do you run Reprocess? Do you think you run Reprocess?
Oh, maybe. I mean, you could run God, Eternal, Bantu, you know?
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
Okay, lots of ideas. Check out the list. But for now, I think we got to move on to the next commander. Do you want to read this one off?
Yes, so this is Galadriel of Lothlorien. So this is a 3/3 elf noble for 3 mana, 1 green-blue. Whenever the ring tempts you, if you chose a creature other than Galadriel of Lothlorien as your ring bearer, scry 3. And whenever you scry, you may reveal the top card of your library. If it's a land card, put it onto the battlefield tapped. So you're getting the, what's his name? The little snaky guy on a scry trigger. Can't remember the...
Coiling Oracle?
Coiling Oracle on a scry trigger. There you go. You're like, ooh, nice, land. Boom.
Yeah, that seems very good. This is a pretty unique deck. I mean, we saw a little bit of scry reward with Elegeth in Commander Legends. But here, this is, I mean, Elegeth costs 6. About a billion mana.
Yeah.
So this one just like comes down a lot earlier, and even though the reward is not as strong, it's still pretty powerful. And you can get it at a really good rate just because there's so many cheap things where like scry is kind of stapled on or just like given to you for not much mana.
And this is one of those ones where you just don't have to care about the ring tempting you like at all. I'm not gonna care about that. I think
I'm running like 1 or 2 cards that tempt you, but not worth it. There's so many other ways to get this thing to go off that you don't need to bother.
It's not really worth like flattening out the deck for something like that, because there's just so many things that scry well anyway, like your Augury Owl, your Sylvan Anthem, you know, gives every green creature that enters the battlefield a scry 1. So boom, all of a sudden you're just ramping like crazy. And because you're ramping like crazy off of the scry, and because it's coming off the top of your deck, like this is one of those decks where I'm going to be like, please, please, please run a higher land count. Like, you do not want to be sitting there with like 35 lands, like whiffing over and over and over again after you've scryed 9, you know?
Oh, like, yeah. I put 41 in here, and that's probably still too low. That's probably, yeah.
I feel like that's where it's good. You're like, okay, we made it to 41. We should probably put more in, but the deck is going to function. If you're sitting there twiddling your thumbs or like dropping stuff, you're like mana screwed. in Galadriel, like you're just doing it wrong. You know, like really, please think about the play pattern and brew appropriately. I know you want to put the cool card in, but you know what's really cool about Commander is you can just make another deck. You can just you can put that card in another deck. Did you know that? It's crazy. It's crazy what they're doing out here. So yeah, let's talk about Galadriel. What are are there any cool pieces of tech that you would want to mention, or is this just going to be like every scry card you can think of?
It's kind of a lot of scry cards. I'd say, I mean, landfall triggers are of course good here. So, you know, you're on color for things like AEC, Tyrant of Gyre Strait, and Tatyova, Benthic Druid. There's sometimes value you can get with things that let you see the top card of your library, like Augur of Autumn. Just if you know that like a land is already on top, then like scrying one off your Temple of Mystery or whatever becomes a lot better. Or, you know, your Sigiled Starfish or something. Not a whole lot of like cleverness in this list, I'm afraid to say, though. It's just, it gets a lot of lands really consistently. What's the win condition? I don't know. up to you.
I love that. Animate your lands. Overrun. Yeah, you know, you'll figure it out. You'll get it.
Yeah, but you are going to have the most lands, I'll tell you that.
Mm-hmm. And it's going to feel so good. Going to look down and just look at everyone else's like pitiful, like 7-8 mana, and look over at your like, yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to feel great. This next one is one of the first cards that they spoiled?
That is a good question. Yes, it was. Yeah.
Okay. I feel like that was true, but I needed to fact check myself. So this is Gandalf the Grey. So this is a 3/4 Avatar Wizard for 5 mana, 3 blue red, and just has a crazy text box. So whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell, choose one that hasn't been chosen. So just forever. just to clarify, choose one that hasn't been chosen, period. So the first option of 4 is you may tap or untap target permanent. Gandalf the Grey deals 3 damage to each opponent. Copy target instant or sorcery spell you control. You may choose new targets for the copy. You might notice that one of these is different than the others. And then put Gandalf on top of its owner's library. Ooh, boy. Yeah, so one of these is absolutely not like one of the others. And it's probably the first one you're going to pick every time. It's untapping your mana dork, am I right? It's getting that extra blue mana for your instant or sorcery. No,
yes.
Yeah, copying your whatever is gonna be nuts. That's crazy.
Yeah, so I think the best thing you can do probably is just doubling up on a tutor to get a 2-card combo. So if you have a Fabricate or some other artifact tutor, you can get like Filigree Sages and Chromatic Orrery. That's infinite mana and infinite card draw. You could also like use your 2 Fabricates to get like a Mindslaver and then an Expedition Map, and the Expedition Map can then get you Academy Ruins. Big mana investment, but whatever. You can get Mesmeric Orb and Basalt Monolith to mill yourself out, and then if you have like a Nexus of Fate in your library, you can just take Envy turns from there. If you have a spell tutor, like a Solve the Equation, you can get like Jessica's Will or Mana Geyser and Reiterate, and that'll get you Infinite Storm and Infinite Mana. So yeah, there's powerful things to be done. That's the only mode I would really pay attention to on this card. Like the rest is a joke. Yeah.
No, absolutely is a joke. I mean, I was joking about untapping something, but you know, untapping your Basalt Monolith is not actually that bad. Mm-hmm. The fact that you can only do it once in this whole like kind of loop cycle is very silly, but I would probably be inclined to play things like Basalt Monolith, Gilded Lotus, things like that in this deck just because it's slightly more powerful because of your commander, but not like that's like going to change the list very much for me. But yeah, I think this is pretty nutso. If you can find ways to flicker him without having to put him on top of your library, although I do think that having that option is valuable because you can save him from just stupid stuff if you need. And then if you, there's always like a Sensei's Divining Top to get him back first or something like that, you know, like do a little bit of top of the library shuffle going on there. But it seems powerful. Doesn't seem like the most powerful Is It commander we've gotten recently. You know, like this definitely still seems pretty fair. As far, it's like 5 mana. and then you have to cast an instant or sorcery, and then you have to figure out what to do with him after that. So that doesn't seem nuts to me, but if you are trying to combo really quickly, I feel like this is probably one of your best options. Does that sound right? Or am I missing something?
I mean, like, if you're trying to combo and Is It, there's always options. This one, like, solves, makes it easier to get your pieces. Yeah, I mean, it is nice that, like, once you get your single copy, like, you just don't have to care about him anymore. Whereas, like, if you're trying to combo off with, say, a Niv-Mizzix, then removal is always relevant. But yeah, it's, I don't have too much more to say about Gandalf the Grey. This next one is pretty compelling, though. This is Eowyn, Fearless Knight. It's 2 red-white for a 3/4 legendary creature human knight. She has haste, and when Eowyn, Fearless Knight enters the battlefield, exile target creature an opponent controls with greater power. Legendary creatures you control gain protection from each of that creature's colors until end of turn. This is pretty darn strong. I mean, it is an ETB commander, which limits, which normally is kind of boring, but the thing is, there's not that many ETB commanders in this particular color identity, so it does more than like an ETB commander in like mono black or mono blue would. So when I see this commander, I think of like Conjurer's Closet, Sword of Hearth and Home, Teleportation Circle, Nahiri's Resolve, copy effects like Duke Older Ravenguard or Jaxxus the Troublemaker. I think Jaxxus can hit legendary creatures, right?
I think so, but I will double check while you're talking about
this. Yes. Yeah. So those kinds of copy effects just basically like use her over and over. Are there any equipment to like that can artificially, or any ways to like artificially lower her power? Probably not, right?
I know, that was what I was thinking about when I first saw her, just to make sure that you can hit like 3+ power guys instead of 4+ power. And it's not super easy in these colors. There's not many like Heartless Summonings or things like that. There might be some equipment, but you'd have to be able to snap it on in response to the trigger so that it checks.
Yeah, probably not.
Not probably the easiest. Not
super viable. So you probably won't be able to just like get rid of everything your opponents have, and there are going to be some utility creatures that can dodge her thing, but she will be pretty good at just like policing your opponent's your like opponent's big fatties. It'll be difficult for your opponents to get like expensive commanders or big fat on the board. So I think that's cool.
I also think one of the things too we talked about with like triggers in the past is like, if like in general the ETB triggers aren't compelling because they're like, it's an ETB trigger, it's small, it like happens one time and then you can't really do it without jumping through a bunch of hoops, and then your deck's gonna look really similar to like other ETB commanders. But when it's something like this that's like so large, you're like, I exiled your best guy and all of my guys get to hit you now, like that's a different story. You know, like that's actually could be massively powerful. That's like a game ending trigger. So I think Eowyn in particular is you don't need to farm the trigger as many times as like some other ETB commanders might need to.
It is worth noting that ETB commanders, like the first one in each color identity, is fine and interesting. It's more just that like subsequent ETB commanders in each color identity don't add a ton to the format because they tend to build around a lot of the same cards. So we haven't really had that many good ETB creatures in red white up until this point. So we'll give her a pass for something that like we normally get annoyed by.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, exactly. Exactly how I feel. This gets passed even though normally I would be annoyed by something like this. Something I'm not annoyed by is the next commander. Do you want to talk about this one?
Sure. Yeah, this next commander is Shadowfax, Lord of Horses. He's 3 red white for a 4/4 legendary creature horse. Horses you control have haste, which means they can attack and tap as soon as they come under your control. And whenever Shadowfax, Lord of Horses attacks, you may put a creature card with lesser power from your hand onto the battlefield, tapped and attacking. So Shadowfax is pretty neat. It's kind of weird. Like, we haven't really seen anything in this color identity before that just cheats creatures into play in this way. I mean, there's like Purphoros, Bronze-Blooded, but you know, adding white definitely like changes the equation here a lot. The fact that you don't have to sacrifice them is really neat, and also like the power limitation makes it so that you're doing it with more like utility creatures, or rather than just like the biggest fat imaginable, you're not dropping in like Blight Steals off of Shadowfax. But this is an interesting commander. I think there's a lot of fun stuff to throw in. Mm-hmm. So there's the classic, like, you know, cheap EDB creatures like Dwargar Hedgemage and Skyclave Apparition, but there's significant like things that actually do hit pretty hard. Like a Darksteel Splicer comes in and makes 3/3/3 indestructible Phyrexian Golems. Ignition Team is a 0/0 that enters the battlefield with X +1/+1 counters on it, where X is the number of tapped lands on the battlefield. So potentially very large when you drop it in on turn 5 after you've tapped out, like could be a 20/20 maybe. So there's a couple fun things like that. Be aware that 0/0s that come in with counters work pretty well. Stars typically do not. So like a Malignus in your hand is still like a 20/20. So don't think you can cheat that guy in.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a very, very important PSA. Stars, the whole reason they exist is that they hold the value like across zones. So be careful.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like a fun deck. There are some powerful things you can do. Like, I love that you can drop in Noblesse of War and then it's attacking, Shadowfax is attacking. You can drop in Aurelia the War Leader. You can drop in Blade Historian.
Yeah.
So sometimes you're dropping in for value. Sometimes you're dropping things in for sick beats. It seems like a fun commander. One thing that might be challenging is just like you're going to empty your hand so fast when you are dropping in all your creatures with Shadowfax, and this is a terrible color identity for like refilling. So be aware that you might end up in top deck mode really quickly, and you're going to want to build your deck to try to ameliorate that. I think like, I guess Sandstone Oracle could work, but that's just one card.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a few things. I feel like Boros
Players. Oh, no, that's not even less power. Oof.
Oh, is it a 4/4?
It's a 4/4.
That's funny. I thought it was like Meteor Golem. It was a 3/3.
Yeah, oof.
Yeah, that is a little oof. I think there's tips and tricks. Like, if you're not one to want to wheel or put a bunch of wheels in a deck like this, then like the artifact synergies are going to stick out for Boros, or like the equipment synergies. There's a little bit more white card draw than there used to be these days, enchantments and whatnot. And if you're not paying for your 4+ drops as you're cheating them in with Shadowfax, then that means that you do have mana to use on activated abilities like Dawn of Hope or like other kind of lame card draw engines. And, you know, beggars can't necessarily be choosers when you're sitting there staring at the top of your library hoping for a miracle. But yeah, I think this is just a fun Boros deck. They got the fun reference in there. They got good gameplay in there. It's an uncommon, just to say that. I don't know if we did. This is one of the uncommon commanders, and it's seems very powerful for an uncommon. So yeah, I think this is a pretty good one. But mostly, I want to get us to the big man himself, you know, head honcho. Yeah.
We're getting to some real heavy hitters here right at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got three more for you, and they are all multi-color, so 3+ colors. And this first one is the eye head himself, you know, the big man, Sauron, the Dark Lord, the progenitor for all future media of the big bad, you know, like, and man, did they deliver. So I guess I'll read them off and you can kind of get into them if that sounds good.
Sure.
So Sauron the Dark Lord is a 7/6 avatar horror for 6 mana, 3 blue, black, red. So we got a Grixis commander. Has a bunch of stuff, so I'm just going to get to it. So ward, sacrifice a legendary artifact or legendary creature. So you don't have a legendary artifact, legendary creature, or uncounterable spell. Well, you just screw you, I guess. Whenever an opponent casts a spell, amass orcs 1. So we haven't talked about amass orcs yet. We're going to talk about it more in the main deck cards, but basically they modified amass, if everyone remembers that. So amass was a trigger where when you were told to amass X, you make a zombie army with X number of +1/+1 counters on it, unless you already have an army, and then you just put that many +1/+1 counters on it. So how they've changed it is now amass orcs means you make an army of orcs, so it's an orc army where you put that many counters on it. And if you amass with multiple different like types, the army gains those creature types as you amass. So like if you amass like from Amonkhet and then you amass orcs with Sauron the Dark Lord, you're going to have a zombie orc army. So it's all additive there. So whenever an army you control deals combat damage to a player, the ring tempts you, which is what we've talked about before. And when the ring tempts you, you may discard your hand. If you do, draw 4 cards. So ward, sacrifice a legendary thing. Whenever an opponent casts a spell, you get a big army. Your army tempts you when it hits people, and whenever you get tempted, you do a mini wheel. You discard your hand and draw 4. All on a 6-mana 7/6. So what is going on here? How does this deck end up playing out?
So, that's a lot of abilities. 2 of them you have no control over, so you can't... I mean, you can build around the reward, but you can't make them trigger more often. Amass Orcs 1, yeah, it's going to happen a lot. Like, I mean, it's going to happen at least 3 times per round of turns, minimum. So it makes sense to run like some good sac outlets that can repeatedly convert those amassed orcs into some other resource. I like attrition for that. There's other cards that you can run that'll be pretty effective there. I didn't try to go too hard on like whenever an army you control deals combat damage to a player, the ring tempts you. I'm just running like, in my list, which you can see in the episode description, I'm running like a Changeling Outcast. Like you could run, if you wanted, you could run like a Cover of Darkness, just a way to give your army evasion so that you can get that trigger. But again, that's only once per turn that you're really able to get that. So I'm not going super deep on that part of the card. What I am going really deep on is this last ability, because that is clearly the headline. That is the most powerful thing going on a very powerful card. Like, I'm running not every single card that tempts you, but a lot of them, pretty much everything that costs like less than three mana or less. So I'm running Nazgul. I'm running like the Black Death. I'm running Birthday Escape. I'm just trying to wheeling for, you know, 1 to 3 mana, even a mini wheel for 1 to 3 mana is an incredible deal. And the way I'm building the deck, it's kind of just like I'm running a ton of like spot removal and counter spells. And the plan is just like I'm going to do a bunch of 1-for-1 trades, and then I'm going to play like a Nazgul and, you know, not quite refill my hand, but get a lot of cards, and then I'm going to empty that and then play another Ring Tempter and just keep doing that and eventually just grind my opponents out of the game. Other fun synergies, like because you are discarding your hand, you don't have to like fully empty it every time. You can just run some cards that like get you value from discarding cards, like Bone Miser or Surly Badger Sore, or like Bag of Holding can like store up the cards that you're discarding. So that's those are some good ways to just get additional advantage. But it, yeah, it just seems like a powerful control deck. I love that you can kind of just like hold removal and like really punish your opponents if they try to take out Sauron. Like if they only have one legendary creature, you can just like, okay, they, you know, target your Sauron with a Go for the Throat. And then in response to the ward triggering, you kill their guy. And then ward trigger resolves. They no longer have a legendary creature to sacrifice. So their spell's just countered. That seems very brutal.
Yeah.
I honestly like didn't invest too much in like win conditions here. This seems like more of a controlling type of deck.
Mm-hmm.
But you can figure that part out for yourself. I believe in you all.
Well, I mean, yeah, you have a 7-power commander. You're going to be running, or you could be running, a lot of removal if you want. And then, like, you get a Sauron with, like, an Archfiend of Ifnir out. And just start doing your thing. So Archfiend of Ifnir is a 5/4 flying demon for 5/3 black. Whenever you cycle or discard a card, put a -1/-1 counter on each creature your opponent's control, and it itself has cycling for 2. I love this card. I've used the crap out of it over the years. And when you're pitching maybe 3 cards to draw 4 and then do it again, you know, just like doing this thing multiple times, that adds up really, really, really fast so that your army can hit them again, your Sauron can hit them again. It's pretty wild, on top of like Glinthorn Buccaneers and things like that. So Brawlin', Skyshark Raiders, which, you know, just deal damage when you discard in general. So that's pretty good. I could not actually believe, well, I could believe actually that they would make the big bad this bad and big and strong. And like, this is a very good Magic card. This is a very good commander. And I hope
can
the
I throw
people
out mm-hmm. one more piece of tech.
Oh, please do.
So one other piece of tech that seems very good in this deck is Retribution of the Ancients. So this is a single black mana for an enchantment. You can pay black and remove +1/+1 counters from among creatures you control to give target creature -x/-x until end of turn.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, every time you amass orcs, so like every time your opponent casts spells, you're adding more counters onto the same orc army. So you are just getting a huge amount of counters over the course of a round of turns, and you can just convert that into kill spells with Retribution of the Meek.
Yeah, that seems really good. Yeah, and then if your opponent tries to like claw back at you, you get orc. You get some orc for it, some orc meat. So, yeah.
Oh, all is around. Meat back on the menu?
Oh my God. Is meat back on the menu? I swear, this was in the Discord too, that I thought I saw a card that referenced that, and I just dreamed it, I guess. I guess I just like imagined that there is a reference to that line. And honestly, it's better that way. So that might be a controversial take, but I like the world that we're living in decently enough right now. So it's okay. It's okay. We don't have that card. Do you want to get into? Yeah, it would have been very good. As long as if it was good, it would have been cool. Because Chef's Kiss, you know, they bungled that one pretty hard. Mm.
Also, like, what is it? You cannot pass. Oof.
Oh yeah. Oops.
Oops.
Anyway. Speaking of, I can't get a transition out of that. Then we're gonna move on to this next one. So we have two more cards for you, and they're both doozies, like our last guy was. So this is Aragorn the Uniter. Aragorn the Uniter is a 5/5 human noble for 4 mana, red, green, white, blue. So whenever you cast a white spell, create a 1/1 white human soldier creature token. Whenever you cast a blue spell, scry 2. Whenever you cast a red spell, Aragorn the Uniter deals 3 damage to target opponent. And whenever you cast a green spell, target creature gets +4/+4 until end of turn. So I actually had... we're going to talk about it, but I had an epiphany and I didn't realize it was target opponent on that third ability, the red one. I thought it was each opponent, so I thought it was a lot easier to do a thing we're going to talk about. Do you want to, I guess, are we getting into this right now, or are we just starting off with this play pattern?
Let's start off with this play pattern.
Okay. Yeah, nice.
I mean, obviously there's a lot of triggers here. And the one that sticks out to me is the one that, well, wins the game instantly if you can do infinite of it. And that's the red one. So you're in so many colors, it seems like it wouldn't be that difficult to assemble combos. I would just try to do like get infinite storm with red spells and just try to burn out my opponents. So there's a lot of ways to do that in this color identity. You can do like Alurin plus Grinning Ignis or Horned Kavu. You can do like Dual Caster Mage plus Release to the Wind or Baral's Expertise. You can do Dockside combos, of which there are many, many, many. You can do like Earthcraft and like Runaway Earthcraft or Runaway Steamkin or Burgee and Grinning Ignis. Or you can do like Reiterate combos, which there's a lot of those as well.
And I do want to mention that, like, how insane it is. It's every 14 red spells, someone is dead. So just to let you, it seems a lot easier than attacking with 1/1 white humans most of the time.
Yes. So yeah, I would definitely try to do that. Even if you're like not going infinite, Grinning Ignis can kind of beat ass.
Yeah, he's getting in there.
Yeah, just the fact that he's like a single red mana for another 3 damage to an opponent. At a certain point, that does get mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, if you can filter mana to red, or you just end up, this deck just has a lot of red mana, like going like, oh, you're at 12?
Like, yeah. Or just like, Dryad of the Elysian Grove or Chromatic Lantern to fix your mana kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it just becomes like Grinning Ignis just seems like a card I would put in this list because, like you said, even if you're not infinite, if you have 7 red mana and someone is at like
20,
yeah, then they're dead. That's it. Like, goodbye. So that's pretty wild. Not stormy about this card. I do like that it lets you kind of pick and choose like which ones of these triggers you would like to use. So obviously the one that kills your opponent very quickly is the strongest option. And because you're in four colors, you can like subsidize that. You can draw, you can tutor, you can, anything you need to do in this deck is here because you're just missing black. But if you wanted to, you could do other stuff to, like, you could make creature tokens and scry. You know, you could focus on like pumping guys. Like, I really like that about this card. It's very powerful, but it really is a card for all of the people, for the Timmies, for the Spikes, for the Johnnies. They really did it with this one. You kind of get to paint by numbers however you like to paint with your Aragorn the Uniter deck, which is pretty hard to do, actually. It's pretty hard to make a card that can appeal to all three major demographics like that.
Yeah. I will say, like, I hate it when they do the clunky, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, like, makes me think they couldn't think of anything cool to do. Like, you know, they were inching up to the deadline, and we're just like, ah, let's do another counting card. Just take a page out of Brea's book, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah, that is a... That's true. I feel like on this card, it's not like as heinous because the card ended up way cooler than Brea. I said it. I'm sorry. I said it, everyone. This card is... I like this card more. But I do totally see what you're talking about. Like, there's... I feel like they probably were really pushed to finish this set, and this is definitely the result of that. But, you know, I feel like this is a hit, you know? They got this one.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a new type of deck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's a new deck. Congrats.
All right, are you ready to move on to the final commander we're going to be covering today?
Yes, and astute Lord of the Ringologist, Tolkienologists. Yeah, might know who this character is, because they were also spoiled very, very early. But do you want to...
Which actor played this in the movie? I can't remember.
Oh, wasn't it Michael Cera? It was...
Yeah, that's right.
So this is Tom Bombadil. Oh boy, Tom Bombadil. So not a character in the movies. This is a 4/4 God Bard for 5 mana. White, blue, black, red, green. As long as there are 4 or more lore counters among sagas you control, Tom Bombadil has hexproof and indestructible. Whenever the final chapter ability of a saga you control resolves, reveal from the top of your library until you reveal a saga card. Put that card onto the battlefield and the rest onto the bottom of your library in a random order. This ability triggers only once each turn. So we got a dedicated, real saga commander. He's here. It's Tom Bombadil. How do you feel about this? What's your take on this guy?
He's pretty neat. We've got a list in the episode description. I think it works fairly well. I mean, he definitely, like, I'm glad that he has a way to protect himself, because he's annoying to cast. He's expensive. And he needs to be on the battlefield kind of like at all times for your deck to really do anything.
Yeah, because it is nice that if you can get to the point where he's protecting himself, you can probably just keep it like that. Like, mm-hmm. Every time you get that final ability, you get another saga to replace it, and then you're casting sagas itself. So hopefully you're just like kept full of cards in hand, full of lore counters on the battlefield, on top of other things you can do with lore counters and stuff like that. Proliferation, I forgot the word for that for a second, and other things. So it was really obvious that this was a niche that needed to be filled. So it is very, very cool that it's being filled. I think with this character too. I think like this is a very good character to have this exist on this kind of thing. But yeah, do you want to talk about tech? Do you want to talk about the sure. sagas? Like, what would
so
you?
So I think it's. Yeah. I honestly think it's like only I mean, the way it is nice that the way he's worded, like, you could get away with running a relatively low count of sagas because he just keeps going until he hits them.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, even if you want to go for, like, high density, there are, like, a lot of options that you can kind of, like, fill out a deck and run, like, 20 sagas and not feel, like, too bad about any of them. This deck works. You probably want a lot of proliferation in this deck. Just so you can, like, spin through your sagas more quickly. Constellation works great here. Your enchantresses aren't that amazing. Like, you'll probably still be casting sagas, even if you're relying on, like, Bombadil flipping through them for you. But they're not... You're maybe casting, like... I think most of the good ones are expensive enough that you're only casting, like, one saga per turn for a while. It's going to be a while before you double spell. So the enchantresses they're fine. Not incredible. This is a great deck for recurring enchantments, clearly. Like, I mean, all your sagas kill themselves. So Hall of Heliod's Generosity is pretty good here. Open the Vaults and similar effects are pretty good here. Let's see. I think that's, like, kind of the main thing. This deck just kind of, like, incidentally runs a lot of board wipes because you've got, like, One Ring to Rule Them All. You've got Phyrexian Scriptures. You've got the Phasing of Zalfir, Battle of Frost and Fire. Kind of funny that there's just, like, a lot of table hate naturally coming out of your sagas, but you may want to consider some more things in addition to that. This deck is, like, pretty slow, pretty unwieldy. Ideally, your commander will be indestructible most of the time, so board wipes are good here. I don't have too much else to say about this as a commander other than just check out the list in the episode description for some ideas. And you may want to run, like, a copy of what's the name of the thing, that the land that you sacrifice and put an indestructible counter on your god?
Oh, the Tyrite Sanctum?
Yes. That you may want to consider that just so you don't have to, like, constantly be tracking your
lore counters.
I think it is a little bit annoying that multiple times over the, or just, like, potentially multiple times over the course of a round of turns, the status of your commander is just going to be fluctuating. Cause, like, oh, I sacked a saga to it after its final ability. So now my lore counters is down to 3 and the, like, Bombadil's trigger hasn't resolved yet. So there's this moment where he's vulnerable before I get my new saga. And it's just like, bookkeeping seems kind of annoying.
Yeah, that actually is true. I actually hadn't thought about that, but just playing with cards that are similar in, like, style, I can only imagine that it'll get old pretty quickly. But yeah, you do also, we have enough sagas to where you can only play with the bangers if you want. You don't just need to, like, jam a bunch of them in. I think the Tyrant Sanctum is a great add. Yeah, you got your normal enchantment synergy cards going on here. So, yeah, I don't think this is a crazy deck. I think it will definitely do a lot. I think if a table isn't ready for an indestructible saga commander, then you're going to get to have a great time, you know? Like, you're going to flip into the Kami War and no one is going to see it coming and it's going to be nuts. But or like the Horus Heresy or something. And it's going to be wild. But that's where we're at. So this is the last legendary creature we're going to talk about today. We're going to mention some at some point in the future in main deck cards or other episodes or whatever. Other podcasts are going to be talking about different cards too. I think we're really mostly just going to do main deck cards and then the commander decks. Of which that's still a massive amount of content
yes.
to get through. But if there is one that you really wish we talked about, please let us know. Hit us up on Discord, email, social media. I do want to hear what you liked that we didn't talk about. I would like to calibrate my interest meter in the brain to see what it is that like more people would like to see. So if there is something that like a bunch of people were like, you forgot about Build the Pony, then, oh man, okay, I don't know, I guess we got to talk about Build the Pony next time, you know, or something, or a card like Build the Pony. But
we're being so mean to Build the Pony.
We are. It's because I love him. I actually do like that card.
He was there was a Lord of the Rings card game in which he was banned for being too good. Do you remember
that's
that?
So funny. I didn't know about that. Oh, I love
they
that.
Should have made this one busted as like a tribute, but
that would have been really funny. So yeah, do you have any, I guess, last thoughts about the legendary creatures in the set before we close this one out?
I would say like, well, let me kick it back to you with a question. Like, sure. How do you feel about having legendary creatures as a theme, knowing that it means like just most of them aren't really going to be worth paying attention to? Like, do you think it's okay that we had like 60 legends that were just like not even worth talking about if it means we had 20 really good ones? Like, are you okay with a low hit rate if the volume of good ones is still high?
Yeah, I actually am, because it also feels like the that's another thing where years down the line, one of these cards that might hit close or not hit at all, like all of a sudden gets something that makes it more applicable. It's going to feel like early Commander days where you're like, oh, you got what here? You're playing your Landreval Horizon Witness deck. Like, what does that look like? So I enjoy that. And it's not like they're taking up space that they're not going to use, like that they couldn't use for. So as an example, like Landreval Horizon Witness isn't making it so they can't make a commander in the future that grants flying to creatures, you know, like none of them are taking up space and making it so that they feel like they're checking boxes. It seems like, from like my perspective, which is usually the reason I don't like when they do stuff like this. They're like, oh, well, we checked all these boxes, so you're all happy now, right? We don't need to think about this for the next like 4 or 5, 6 years. But in this instance, it really seems like that's not the case. So yeah, I'm okay with like weird, like Samwise the Stout-Hearted and stuff. If like 20 plus of the cards are bangers, and some of them, like we talked about, some of them are just cool, but we just didn't talk about them. I really like Gorbag of Minas Morgul is just like a goblin orc tribal guy. There's just like not a lot of goblins or orcs, but like, if you put him in your red black goblin or orc deck, you get a bunch of treasuring cards, you know, like he's a pretty good card in that regard. So I don't think it's awful. And I also do think it makes the white color pie and the white tutoring system that they have going a lot better at the same time. You know, like tutoring for legends is better when there are more legends to tutor for and like more varied things. So that's like a, in a weird way, it's like buffing white's suite of the color pie. So yeah, I guess I'm more okay with it. I know that there are people that don't feel the same way as me. Well, I am going to say that I'm very excited to get to the main deck cards. And there might also have been some cards that you might have been surprised we didn't talk about, like the Watcher in the Water. If you were on social media, you'd see that there's some people who very much were impressed with this card. And if you can guess from the set review, me and Nick very much were not impressed with it. I do like seeing all of the different versions of creatures. I think that's like a fun way to do multiple different legends. And also, if you're going to have like a really short stint with like an IP, like instead of having the one Frodo, the definitive Frodo that everyone has to play with, and putting that much like stress on yourself, like having three different Frodos is like a lot, not just easier on you and your design team, but more satisfying for players, because like Frodo is a more interesting, complex like there Frodo isn't just white black, so having a Frodo that isn't just white black all the time makes sense.
All right, with that, we got to wrap up the episode, so I'm going to give a brief thank you to our Patreon patrons. They are Gustav, Ryan, Addison, Rick, Raphael, Kyle, Laser, Charlotte, Hannah, Andy, James, Bryce, Benjamin, Brandon, Kydell, Jeremy, Russell, Dylan, John, Micah, Troy, Roxanne, Daniel, Andrew, Jason, Paul, Johan, Jonathan, Christian, Jim, Andrew, Vasilios, Logan, Fugger, Riddle, Carl Oscar, Danny B, Jean-Francois, Drew, Recta, Nick, BJ, Cameron, Valerio, Quincy, Carrie, Stephen, The Longs, Vincent, Maceo, Dylan, Cameron, Icy Wiener, Aiden, and Scott. Thank you all for supporting the show. And if you're not currently a Patreon patron, but would like to become one, please check us out at patreon.com/commandertheory. Thanks for listening.
Woo!
You can reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at Commander Theory.
And on Twitter, I am at Fat Bartleby.
You can also email us at commandertheory@gmail.com. Our theme song is Lincoln Continental by Nick Cage. You can check him out on SoundCloud.
And if you're interested in some other creative projects I'm working on, I have a band you can check out. We are a pink punk, pop punk band called The Have Nots, all one word like cosmonauts. You can listen to all of our music for free right now. You can just head over to thehavenots.bandcamp.com. That is thehavnauts.bandcamp.com. And check us out. Let me know what you think.